said to the rabbit's head, then got out and closed the door, giving Theodore a smile through the window. Charlie walked the trail slowly. The hulking, unfinished frames of the houses seemed to watch her reproachfully as she trespassed. The gravel crunched under her feet in the silence. There wasn't even a breeze. Everything was still. She stopped when she reached higher ground and surveyed her surroundings for a moment. Everything was disturbed. Everything was upturned. She glanced above her as a single bird passed overhead, barely visible from its soaring height. Her eyes returned to the wasteland. "You're here somewhere, aren't you?" At last she reached the lone, finished house. It was set at the center of a neat square of perfectly trimmed grass, towering above its stooped, half-constructed neighbors. Charlie stared at the lawn for a moment before realizing that it must be fake, just like whatever furniture was inside. She didn't try the door right away, instead going around to the backyard. It was laid out in a neat square of astroturf, just like the front, but here the illusion had been ruined. Ragged strips of grass had been torn up. The place radiated a sense of distress, now eerily familiar. Charlie just stared for a moment, certainty pulsing through her. She clenched her jaw, then went back around to the front door. It opened easily, without even a whisper of sound, and Charlie went inside. It was dark in the house. She flipped a light switch experimentally, and it illuminated the whole place in an instant. A fully furnished living room greeted her, complete with leather chairs and a couch, and even candles on the fireplace mantel. She started to close the front door behind her, then hesitated, leaving it ajar. She walked farther into the living room, where there was an L-shaped couch and a widescreen TV. "I'm surprised it hasn't been stolen," she thought. But when she went closer, she saw why. It wasn't real. There were no cords or cables coming from it. The whole place had a surreal quality, almost of mockery. She walked slowly into the dining room, her feet clapping against the polished hardwood floor. Inside was a beautiful, mahogany dining set. Charlie bent over to look at the underside of the table. "Balsa wood," she said, grinning to herself. It was a light, airy wood, made for model airplanes, not furniture. She could probably lift the table over her head if she wanted to. Down a short hallway from the dining room was a kitchen with gleaming new appliances, or at least imitations of them. There was also a back door in the kitchen. She unlocked it and pushed it open halfway, leaning outside and looking again at the expansive, tortured landscape. There were several stone steps here, leading down into a small garden. She stepped back inside, being sure to leave the door hanging slightly open. There was a second long hall off the living room. This led to bedrooms and a small room fashioned into an office or den, complete with tall bookshelves, a desk, and an inbox tray full of empty file folders. Charlie sat down in the desk chair, finding herself enchanted by the utterly surface imitation of life. She spun the chair once, then stood again, not wanting to get distracted. There was a door to the outside here, too, though it was oddly placed beside the desk. Charlie opened it, fiddling with the latch until she was sure it would stay open. She continued on her way, walking through the house systematically, unlocking and opening each window she came to. Then she went down to the basement, where a storm cellar hung over a set of steep stone stairs. She opened that as well, leaving the doors gaping wide. Outside, dark had fallen. There were several bedrooms, each furnished and made up with bright curtains and silk sheets, and a large bathroom with marble sinks. Charlie turned the faucet to see if there was water, but nothing happened, not even the grinding of pipes trying and failing. There was a master bedroom with an enormous bed, a guest room that somehow looked even less lived in than the rest of the house, and a nursery with a life-size menagerie painted on the wall and a mobile hanging above a crib. Charlie glanced inside each, then went back into the master bedroom. The bed was wide and covered in a light canopy of white mosquito netting. The covers were white as well, and the moon shone through the window to illuminate the pillows. It had an uncanny effect, as if whoever slept there would be on display. Charlie went to the window and leaned out, breathing in the soothing, cool night air. She looked up at the sky. It was still cloudy. There were only a few stars visible. She'd been moving with such grim, impulsive energy until now, but this part would be agonizing. Long hours might pass before anything happened, and all she could do was wait. A nervous fluttering had begun to fill her stomach. She wanted to pace, or even to run away, but she closed her eyes and clenched her jaw. It's me they want. At last, Charlie pulled herself away from the window. She'd packed pajamas in the bag out in the car, but this sterile house full of props and imitations felt too strange for her to actually dress for bed. Instead, she just took off her sneakers and considered her bedtime rituals complete. She laid down on the bed and tried to conjure her nightmares, gathering up those final moments with Sammy and holding them close to her like a talisman. Hold on, she thought. I'm coming. John checked his watch. She's just running late, but she was late last time, too. The waitress caught his eye, and he shook his head. Of course, last time she showed up covered in filth. He'd already called her dorm room, but the phone just rang and rang. He'd seen what he'd thought was an answering machine when he was there, but realized only as he was waiting for it to pick up that it could have been one of Charlie's projects, or some piece of discarded junk. The waitress refilled his water glass, and he smiled at her. She shook her head. Same girl? She asked gently. John let out an involuntary laugh. Yes, same girl, he said. But it's okay. She's not standing me up. She's just busy. College life, you know? Of course. Let me know if you want to order. She gave him another look of pity and went away. He shook his head. Suddenly, he saw Charlie's hands on her backpack straps, holding on so tight that her knuckles had gone white. They're coming for me, she'd said. Charlie wasn't the type to wait around patiently for something to happen to her. He got up and walked urgently to the payphone at the back of the restaurant. Clay picked up on the first ring. Clay, it's John. Have you heard from Charlie? No. What's wrong? Nothing, John said reflexively. I mean, I don't know. She was supposed to meet me, and she's 24 minutes late. I know it's not a lot, but she said something earlier that's bothering me. I think she might do something stupid. Where are you? John gave him the address. I'll be right there, Clay said, and hung up before John could reply. Chapter 10. For the first few minutes, Charlie kept her eyes shut, feigning sleep, but after a little while they began to flutter of their own accord. She squeezed her eyes shut, trying to force them to stay closed, but it became unbearable. She opened them into the darkness and at once felt relief. The house had grown cool with night. The open window let in fresh, clean air. She breathed deeply, trying with each exhalation to make herself calm. She wasn't anxious so much as impatient. Hurry up, she thought. I know you're out there. But there was only silence and stillness. She took the disc out of her pocket and looked at it. It was too dark to see any details, not that there was anything on it she hadn't already memorized. A little light shone in from the moon outside, but the shadows in the corners were deep, like there was something hidden there, eating up the light. She rubbed the side of the disc with her thumb, feeling the bumps of the letters. If she didn't know they were there, they'd be scarcely noticeable. Afton Robotics, LLC. She'd seen pictures of William Afton, the man who Dave had been, pictures of him with her father, smiling and laughing. But she only remembered him as the man in the rabbit suit. My father must have trusted him. He must not have suspected. He would never have built a second restaurant with the man who murdered one of his children. But those creatures, he had to have known they were buried beneath our house. Charlie clenched her teeth, stifling a sudden delirious urge to smile. Of course there was a secret robot graveyard under my bedroom, she murmured. Of course that's where it would be. She covered her face in her hands. All the threads were tangling in her mind. She pictured it unwillingly. The creature in the doorway. At first he was a shadow, blocking the light. Then he was a man in a rabbit suit. And even then it didn't occur to Charlie to be afraid. She knew this rabbit. Sammy hadn't even noticed him yet. He continued to play with his toy truck, running it back and forth hypnotically across the floor. Charlie stared up at the thing in the doorway, and a coldness began to gather in the pit of her stomach. This was not the rabbit she knew. Its eyes shifted back and forth subtly between the twins, taking its time, making its choice. When the eyes settled on Charlie, the cold feeling spread all through her. Then he looked away again, at Sammy, who still hadn't turned around. Then a sudden movement, and the costumes on their hangers all leaped together, covering her so she couldn't see. She heard the toy truck hit the ground and spin in place for a moment. Then everything was still. She was alone, a vital part of her cut away. Charlie sat up, shaking herself to try and set the memories loose. She'd grown accustomed to sharing a room with Jessica. It was a long time since she'd been completely alone with her thoughts in the dark. "I forgot how hard it is to be quiet," she whispered, her voice as soft as breath. She glared down at the strange disc in her hand, as if it was bringing these visions on her. She tossed it across the room and into a dark corner, out of sight. Then she heard it. Something was inside the house. Whatever it was being cautious. She heard creaks from somewhere distant, but they were slow and muted. Silence followed. Whatever moved was hoping the sound would be forgotten. Charlie crept from the bed and approached the door carefully, pushing it farther open and leaning out agonizingly slowly, until she could see deep into the living room and the dining room beyond that. A part of her kept returning to the thought that she was in someone else's house, that she was the intruder. "Hello?" she called, almost hoping for an answer, even an angry one demanding to know what she was doing there. Maybe John would answer, happy to have found her, and come running from the darkness. Only silence returned her call, but Charlie knew she wasn't alone anymore. Her eyes widened, her heartbeat drumming in her throat, making it hard to breathe. She took careful steps over the stone tiles, down the short hall to just outside the living room, where she stood to listen again. A clock chimed the hours in a different room. Charlie walked to the edge of the living room and stopped again. She could see most of the house from here, and she scanned the area for anything out of place. Doorways surrounded her like gaping mouths, breathing night air from the windows she'd opened. There was a long hall leading from the farthest corner of the living room to a different bedroom. It was one of the few places she didn't have a clear line of sight into. She edged around the leather sofa in front of her and across the circular rug that filled the room. As she walked, she could see more of the hall slowly revealing itself. It stretched out, farther and farther. Charlie stopped mid-step. She could see into the far bedroom now. It was full of windows and blue moonlight, and there was something obstructing her view, something she hadn't noticed while she was moving. Now its silhouette was unmistakable. Charlie carefully looked around again, her eyes adjusting to her surroundings. To her right, another large door led down a single step and into the large den. Bookcases stretched up to the ceiling, and a putrid air emanated from inside. Beyond the bookcases was another shadow that didn't belong. Charlie bumped into a lamp and startled. She hadn't even realized she was moving backward. The front door was open wide. Charlie nearly bolted toward it to escape, but she stopped herself. She took a breath and stepped softly back toward the bedroom, checking over her shoulder as she went. She went back to the bed, sliding her bare feet on the wood floor so her steps would make no sound, and eased herself slowly onto the mattress, cautious to keep the springs from creaking. Charlie lay back, closed her eyes, and waited. Her eyes twitched, every instinct she had shouting the same thing. "Open your eyes. Run." Charlie breathed steadily in and out, trying to make her body go limp, trying to look asleep. "Something is moving." She counted the steps. 1, 2, 1, 2. No. They were slightly asynchronous. There was more than one of them. 2, maybe all 3, were inside the house. One set of footsteps passed her door, and she let her eyes flutter open for an instant, just in time to see an indistinct shadow cross before the crack in the door. Another set of footsteps sounded like they were in the side hallway, while a third. She screwed her eyes shut tight. The steps fell still outside her door. Her breath was shuddering. She almost hiccuped as she inhaled and she bit her lips together. The door was gliding open. Her lungs tightened, pressing her for air, but she refused. She hung on to that single breath as if it were the last one she'd ever get. "I'll find you." She clenched her fists, determined to remain still. The footsteps were through the door now, crossing the floor with a heavy tread. She kept still. The air above her stirred, and through her closed eyelids, the darkness grew even darker. Charlie opened her eyes and breathed in. The space above her was empty. Nothing was looking down at her. She turned her head slowly, peering into the open hall to her left. The noises had all stopped. Suddenly, the blankets were yanked off her, pulled from the foot of the bed. Charlie shot up and finally saw what had come for her. An enormous head rested its chin at her feet. It looked like something from a carnival game, its eyes rolling from side to side, clicking each time they moved. A pitch-black top hat was perched on its head, cocked slightly to one side, and the giant cheeks and button nose gave him away immediately. Freddy. It was no longer the sleek and featureless head she had unearthed in the abandoned lot. His head was lively and full of movement, covered in wavy brown fur and bouncy cheeks. Yet there was something disjointed about it all, as though every part of his face was moving independently. Charlie fought to remain still, but her body was acting of its own accord, squirming and pulling to get away from the mouth opening up toward her. Freddy's face slid across the bed like a python. His head lost its shape as it folded outward, taking hold of her feet and beginning to swallow, moving slowly upward as she fought not to scream or fight. A giant arm reached up and clapped the side of the bed, shaking the room as it anchored itself and pulled the giant torso higher. Freddy's jaw made motions of chewing as the distorted face pulled Charlie's legs inside it, his cheeks and chin dislocating further. It no longer resembled a living thing. Panic took hold and Charlie screamed. She clenched her fists, but there was no longer a face to strike. There was only a squeezing and spiraling vortex of fur, teeth, and wire. Before she could struggle further, her arms were pinned to her side, trapped inside the thing. Only her head remained free. She gasped for a last breath, then was violently scooped up, consumed by the creature. Clay Burke stopped the car without slowing down. The brakes screeched as they fishtailed in the dirt. John was out of the car before Clay had gotten it under control, running up the hill toward the house. "Around back," Clay said, catching up to John, his voice low and tight. They made their way around the house to the back door, which was gaping open.
"Check that way."
Clay gestured to his right as he ran left. John stuck close to the wall, peering into doorways as he passed them.
"Charlie,"
he cried.
"Charlie,"
Clay echoed, entering the master bedroom.
"Charlie!"
John ran from room to room, moving faster.
"Charlie!"
He arrived at the front door. He swung it wide open and stepped outside, half expecting to catch someone fleeing the scene.
"Clay, did you find her?"
he shouted as he raced back inside. Clay walked briskly back into the living room, shaking his head.
"No, but she was here. The bed was unmade and there was dirt all over the floor. And these..."
He held up Charlie's sneakers. John nodded grimly, only now noticing the trails of dirt strewn through the house. He glanced again to the front door.
"She's gone," John said, his voice catching in his throat.
He looked at the older man.
"Now what?"
he asked. Clay just stared at the floor and said nothing. Chapter 11.
"Clay!" John repeated.
His alarm grew as the older man stared down at the dirty floorboards, apparently lost in thought. John put a hand on his arm, and Clay startled. He looked as if he'd just realized he wasn't alone.
"We have to find her," John said urgently.
Clay nodded, springing back to life. He broke into a run and John followed close at heel, barely making it into the passenger's seat before Clay started the engine and took off, speeding down the half-made road.
"Where are we going?"
John shouted. He was still struggling to close the door against the wind. It flapped like a massive wing, pulling against him as Clay swerved down the hill. Finally, John yanked it shut.
"I don't know," Clay said grimly. "But we know about how far they can get."
He drove wildly back down the hill and out to the main road, flipping on his police lights. They went less than a mile before he turned quickly onto a small, unpaved lane. John's shoulder banged hard against the door. He gripped his seatbelt as they barreled down the trail, high brush scraping the sides of the car and thumping the windshield.
"They have to come through here," Clay said. "This field is right in the middle of the path between that house and the next area on the map. We just have to wait for them."
He stopped the car abruptly and John jerked forward. Together, they got out of the car. Clay had stopped at the edge of an open field. There were trees scattered here and there, and the grass was tall, but there were no crops and no livestock grazed. John walked out into the open, watching the grass ripple like water in the wind.
"You really think they'll come by here?" John asked. "If they keep moving the direction they've been going," Clay said, "they have to."
Long minutes passed. John paced back and forth in front of the car. Clay positioned himself closer to the middle of the field, ready to run in any direction at a moment's notice.
"They should have been here by now," John said. "Something's wrong."
He glanced at Clay, who nodded. The sound of a car engine rose from the distance, growing louder. They both froze. Whoever it was, they were coming fast. John could hear branches whipping against the car's body in an irregular percussion. After a few seconds, the car shot out from the lane and screeched to a halt.
Jessica. John walked toward the car.
Where's Charlie?
Jessica asked, stepping out onto the grass.
How did you find us? Clay demanded. I called her, John put in quickly. From the restaurant, right after I talked to you.
I've been driving all over the place. I'm lucky I found you. Why are we stopped here?
Their route crosses through here, John explained, but she looked skeptical.
What does that mean? How do you know?
John glanced at Clay, neither of them looking confident.
They have her already, right?
Jessica said.
So why would they keep going toward her dorm?
Clay closed his eyes, putting a hand to his temples.
They wouldn't, he said.
He looked up at the sky, the wind battering across his upturned face with a raw touch.
So they could be going anywhere now, Jessica added.
We can't predict what they're doing anymore, John said. They got what they wanted.
And she wanted this? She planned this? Jessica said, her voice rising. What's wrong with you, Charlie?
She turned back to John.
They might not have even wanted her. It could have been anyone. So why did she have to go up there? Like some kind of...
Sacrifice, John said quietly.
She can't be dead,
Jessica muttered, her voice shaky even under her breath.
We can't think like that, John said sternly. We'll form a perimeter, Clay said. Jessica, you and John take your car and start driving that way, he pointed. I'll loop back in the other direction. We'll make circles and hope we catch them. I can't think of any other way.
He looked at the teenagers helplessly. No one moved, despite Clay's new plan. John could feel it in the air. They had all surrendered.
I don't know what else to do.
Clay's voice had lost its strength.
I might, John said abruptly, the idea forming even as he spoke. Maybe we can ask them.
You want to ask them? Jessica said sarcastically. Let's call them and leave a message. Please call us back with your murderous plot at your earliest convenience.
Exactly, John said. Clay, the mascots from Freddy's, are they all gone? When you say you threw them out, what does that mean? Can we get access to them?
He turned to Jessica.
They helped us before, or at least they tried to, once they stopped trying to kill us. They might know something. I don't know. Even if they're on a scrap heap somewhere, there must be something left. Clay?
Clay had turned his face up to the sky again. Jessica gave him a sharp look.
You know, don't you? She said. You know where they are.
Clay sighed.
Yeah, I know where they are.
He hesitated.
I couldn't let them be dismantled, he went on, not knowing what they are, who they had been. And I didn't dare let them be casually tossed out, considering what they're capable of doing.
Jessica opened her mouth, about to ask a question, then stopped herself.
I kept them,
Clay said. There was a rare note of uncertainty in his voice.
You what?
John stepped forward, suddenly on guard.
I kept them. All of them. I didn't know about asking them any questions, though. Ever since that night, they haven't moved an inch. They're broken, or at least they're doing a good impression of it. They've been sitting in my basement for over a year now. I've been careful to leave them alone. It just seemed like they shouldn't be disturbed.
Well, we have to disturb them, Jessica said. We have to try to find Charlie.
John scarcely heard her. He was staring searchingly at Clay.
Come on, Clay said.
He set off toward his car with a heavy look,
as if something had just been taken from him. John and Jessica exchanged a glance, then followed. Before they reached Jessica's car, Clay was already heading toward the main road. Jessica stepped on the gas, catching up just as Clay made a sharp right turn. They didn't speak. Jessica was intent on the road, and John was slouched in his seat, thinking things through. Ahead of them, Clay had switched on his flashing lights, though he left off the siren. John stared into the darkness as they drove. Maybe he'd spot Charlie just by chance. He kept his hand loose on the door handle, ready to jump out, to run and save her. But there were only endless trees, scattered with the orange windows of distant houses, which hung on the hills like Christmas lights.
"We're here," Jessica said, sooner than John had expected.
John pushed himself upright and peered out the window. She made a left turn and slowed the car down, and as she did, John recognized it. A few yards ahead was Carlton's house, surrounded by a cove of trees. Clay pulled into the driveway and they came in behind him. Jessica stopped the car inches from his bumper. Clay jangled his keys nervously as they approached the house. He looked like an altered man, no longer the assured police chief in control of every situation. He unlocked the door, but John hung back. He wanted Clay to go in first. Clay led them into the living room, and Jessica made a noise of surprise. Clay gave her a sheepish look.
"Sorry for the mess," he said.
John glanced around. The room was mostly the same as he remembered, full of couches and chairs all fanned around a fireplace. But both couches were piled with open files and stacks of newspapers, and what looked like dirty laundry. Six coffee mugs sat crowded together on a single end table. John's heart sank as he noticed two bottles of whiskey lying on their sides, between an armchair and the hearth. He cast his eyes around quickly, spotting two more. One had rolled under a couch. The other was still half full, sitting beside a glass with a distinct yellow tinge. John snuck a look at Jessica, who bit her lip.
"What happened here?" she asked.
"Betty left," Clay said shortly.
"Oh."
"I'm sorry," John offered.
Clay waved a hand at him, staving off further attempts at comfort. He cleared his throat.
"She was right, I guess. Or at least she did what was right for her."
He forced a laugh and gestured at the mess that surrounded him.
"We all do what we have to do."
He sat down in a green armchair, the only seat completely free of paperwork and debris, and shook his head.
"Can I move these?" John asked, pointing to the papers that filled the couch opposite Clay.
Clay didn't respond, so John stacked them up and put them to one side, careful not to let anything fall. He sat, and after a moment, so did Jessica, though she eyed the couch as if she thought it might be carrying the plague.
"Clay," John started, but the older man started talking again, as if he'd never stopped. "After all of you left, after all of you were safe, I went back for them. Betty and I had decided it might be a good time for Carlton to get out of town for a while, so she took him to stay with her sister for a few weeks. To be honest, I don't remember if she suggested it, or if it was me who put the idea in her mind. But as soon as I saw them pull down the driveway and out of sight, I got to work. Freddy's was locked up. They'd taken away Officer Dunn's body and completed their search, under my careful guidance, of course. They took some samples, but nothing else had been removed from the premises. Not yet. They were waiting on me to give the go-ahead. The place wasn't even under guard. After all, there was nothing dangerous inside, right? So I waited for things to calm down. Then I drove to St. George and rented a U-Haul. It was raining when I picked up the truck, and by the time I got to Freddy's, there was a full-on thunderstorm, even though the forecast had been clear. I had keys this time. All the locks were police issue now, so I just walked right into the place. I knew where I would find them, or at least I knew where I'd left them, and prayed they were still here. They were all piled together in that room with the little stage.
Pirate's Cove, Jessica said, her voice barely a whisper.
I half expected them to be gone, but they were sitting patiently, like they'd been waiting for me. They're immense, you know. Hundreds of pounds of metal, and whatever else was in there. So I had to drag them one by one. I loaded them all up eventually. I figured I would bring them down through the storm cellar. But when I got back home, the lights were on, and Betty's car was in the driveway. She'd come back from her trip early, it seemed.
What did you do? Jessica asked.
She was hunched over, her chin in her palms. John shook his head, mildly amused. She was enjoying the story.
I waited across the street. I watched the lights, staking out my own house. When the last light went out, I pulled into the driveway and started dragging those things again, lowering them down into the cellar one by one. I drove the truck back to St. George and came back home, all without anyone seeing me. It would have never worked if I hadn't had the cover of thunder and lightning to mask what I was doing. When I came in, I was soaking wet, and my whole body ached. All I wanted was to go upstairs to bed, next to my wife. He cleared his throat. But I didn't dare. I took a blanket and I slept in front of the basement door, just in case something tried to come out.
Did it? Jessica asked.
Clay shook his head slowly back and forth, like it had taken on extra weight.
In the morning, they were exactly the way I'd left them. Every night after that, I went down there when Betty was asleep. I watched them. Sometimes I even talked to them, trying to provoke them somehow. I wanted to make sure they weren't going to kill us in our sleep. I went back over the case files, trying to figure out how we'd missed Afton. How had he managed to come back without anyone suspecting? Betty could tell something was wrong. A few weeks later, she woke up and came looking for me. She found me, and them.
Burke closed his eyes.
I don't remember exactly how the conversation went, but the next morning she was gone again, and this time she didn't come back.
John shifted on the couch restlessly.
They haven't moved since then? They're just sitting there like broken dolls. I don't even think about them anymore. Clay, Charlie's in danger, John said, standing. We have to go see them.
Clay nodded.
Well, then let's go see them.
He stood and gestured toward the kitchen. The last time John had stood in the Burke's kitchen was the morning after they'd all escaped from Freddy's. Clay had been making pancakes and kidding around. Betty, Carlton's mother, was sitting next to her son as if she were afraid to leave his side. They were all giddy with relief that the ordeal was over, but John could tell that each of them, in their own particular ways, was struggling with other emotions too. Someone might stop talking in mid-sentence, forgetting the rest, or stare for several moments at the empty air in front of them. They were all just barely recovering. But the kitchen had been bright. Light sparkled off the counters, and smells of coffee and pancakes were reassuring, a connection to reality. Now, John was struck hard by the contrast. There was a rank smell, and he could see immediately what it was. The counters and table were strewn with dirty dishes, all crusted with leftover meals. Most had scarcely been eaten.
There were two more empty bottles in the kitchen sink. Clay opened the door to what looked like a closet, but turned out to be the basement steps. He flipped a light switch, illuminating a dim bulb right above the stairs, and motioned them in. Jessica started forward, but John put a hand lightly on her arm, stopping her. Clay went first, leading their descent, and John followed, guiding Jessica behind him. The stairs were narrow and a little too steep. Each time John stepped down, he felt a slight lurch, his body unprepared for the distance. Two steps down, the air changed. It was damp and moldy.
"Watch out for that one," Clay said.
John looked down to see that one of the boards was missing. He stepped over it carefully and turned, offering Jessica a hand as she made the awkward jump.
"One of the many things that's on my to-do list," Clay said offhandedly.
The basement itself was unfinished. The floor and walls were nothing but the unpainted inner surface of the foundation. Clay gestured to a dark corner where the boiler lurked heavily. Jessica gasped. They were all there, lined up in a row against the wall. At the end of the line, Bonnie slumped against the boiler. The gigantic rabbit's blue fur was stained and matted, and his long ears drooped forward, almost obscuring his wide, square face. He still held a red bass guitar in one enormous hand, though it was battered and broken. Half of his bright red bow tie had torn off, giving his face a lopsided look. Beside him sat Freddy Fazbear. His top hat and matching black bow tie were undamaged, their material only a little scuffed. And though his brown fur was bedraggled, he still smiled for an absent audience. His blue eyes were wide and his eyebrows raised, like something exciting was about to happen. His microphone was missing, and he held his arms out stiffly before him, grasping at nothing. Chica leaned against Freddy, her head drooping to the side. The weight of her yellow body, inexplicably covered in fur, not feathers, seemed to rest entirely on him. Her long, orange chicken legs were splayed out in front of her, and for the first time, John noticed the silver talons on her feet, inches long and sharp as knives. The bib she always wore had been torn. It had read, "Let's eat," but it was faded by time, along with the damp and mildew of the basement. John squinted at her. Something else was missing.
"The cupcake," Jessica said, echoing his thoughts.
Then he spotted it.
"There, on the floor," he said.
It was sitting alone beside Chica, almost huddled, its evil grin maniacal and pathetic. Set a little apart from the three was the yellow Freddy, the one that had saved all their lives. He looked like Freddy Fazbear, and yet he did not. There was something different about him besides the color, but if someone had asked John what it was, he knew he wouldn't be able to name it. Jessica and John looked at it for a long moment. John felt a sense of quiet awe as he studied the yellow bear.
"I never got to thank you," he wanted to say, but he found he was too scared to approach it.
"Where's—"
Jessica started, then cut herself off. She pointed to the corner where Foxy was propped against the wall, clothed in shadows but still visible. John knew what he would see— a robotic skeleton covered with dark red fur, but only from the knees up. It had been tattered even when the restaurant was open. Foxy had his own stage in Pirate's Cove. As John peered at him now, he thought he could see more places where the fur covering was ripped, and the metal frame showed through. Foxy's eye patch was still fixed in place above his eye. While one hand drooped at his side, the arm with the large, sharpened hook was raised above his head, poised for a downward slash.
"Is this how you left them?" John asked.
"Yep."
Exactly how I left them,
Clay answered, but he sounded suspicious of his own words. Jessica approached Bonnie cautiously and crouched down to make her eyes level with the enormous rabbit.
Are you in there?
She whispered. There was no response. Jessica reached out slowly to touch his face. John watched, tensing, but as Jessica petted the rabbit, not even dust stirred in the mildewed basement. Finally, she straightened and took a step back, then looked helplessly at John.
There's nothing.
Shh, he interrupted. A noise caught his attention.
What is it?
John bent his head, craning closer to the sound, though he couldn't tell exactly where it was coming from. It was like a voice on the wind, words swept away before he could catch them, so that he couldn't be sure it was a voice at all.
Is anyone here?
He murmured. He looked at Freddy Fazbear, but as he tried to focus his attention, the sound situated itself. He turned to the yellow Freddy suit.
You're here, aren't you?
He asked the bear. He went to the animatronic and crouched in front of it, but he didn't try to touch it. John looked into its shining eyes, searching for any of the spark of life he had seen that night, when the golden bear entered the room, and they all knew as irrefutable fact that Michael, their childhood friend, was inside. John couldn't remember precisely how that knowledge had come. There was nothing behind the plastic eyes, nothing different physically. It was just pure certainty. He closed his eyes, trying to call it back. Maybe by recalling that essence of Michael, he could conjure him again. But he couldn't catch it, couldn't sense the presence of his friend as he had that night. John opened his eyes and looked at all the animatronics one by one, remembering them alive and mobile. Once, the children stolen by William Afton had watched him back from inside. Were they still inside now, dormant? It was horrible to think of them moldering down here, staring into the darkness. Something flickered in the yellow bear's eye, almost imperceptibly, and John drew in a sharp breath. He glanced behind, checking for a light that might have glanced off the hard plastic surface, but there was no obvious source. Come back, he pled silently, hoping to see the spark again.
John?
Jessica's voice pulled him back to reality.
John, I'm not sure that this was a good idea.
He turned toward her voice, then stood, his legs cramping. How long had he been there, staring into the blind eyes of the mascot?
I think there's still someone in there, he said slowly.
Maybe so, but this doesn't feel right.
She looked down from John toward the suits again. Their heads had moved. They tilted up unnaturally, facing John and Jessica. Jessica screamed and John heard himself shout something unintelligible, leaping back as if he'd been stung. They were all looking directly at him. John took three experimental steps to the left, and they appeared to track him. Their eyes stayed fixed on him, and him alone. Clay had grabbed a shovel and was holding it like a baseball bat, ready to strike.
I think it's time to go.
He stepped forward.
Stop, it's okay, John exclaimed. They know that we aren't enemies. We're here because we need their help.
John opened his palms toward the creatures. Clay lowered the shovel, though he kept it in his hand. John looked at Jessica, who nodded rapidly. John turned back to the mascots.
We're here because we need your help, he said again.
They gazed back at him blankly.
Remember me?
He asked awkwardly. They continued to stare, as frozen in their new poses as they'd been before.
Please listen, he went on. Charlie, you remember her, right? You must. She's been taken by creatures like you, but not like you.
He glanced at Jessica, but she was watching anxiously, trusting this to him.
They were animatronic suits, buried under Charlie's house. We don't know why they were there.
He took a deep breath.
We don't think they were built by Henry. We think they were built by William Afton.
As soon as John said the name, the robots all began to shudder, convulsing where they sat. It was as if their machinery was being jump-started by a current too powerful for their systems to absorb.
John!
Jessica cried. Clay stepped forward and grabbed John by the shoulder.
We have to get out of here, Jessica said urgently.
The mascots were seizing wildly, their arms and legs jerking. Their heads banged against the back wall with painful clanks. John stood rooted to the spot, torn between the impulse to run to them, to try and help, and the urge to run away.
Go, now!
Clay shouted over the noise, pulling John backward. They made their way back up the basement stairs. Clay followed behind with the shovel raised defensively. John watched the mascots convulsing on the ground until they were out of sight.
We need your help to find Charlie,
he shouted one last time, as Clay slammed the basement door and snapped three shiny new deadbolts shut.
Come on, Clay said.
They followed him, chased by hideous clanking and banging noises, only slightly muffled by the floor beneath. He led them back through the living room to a small study branching off from it, where he shut the door and bolted it.
They're coming up, John said, pacing and watching the ground beneath his feet.
Metal ground against metal. Something crashed like it was slammed against the wall. The echo reverberated through the floor.
Block the door, Clay ordered, grabbing one side of the desk in the corner.
John grabbed the other side as Jessica cleared a path for them, yanking two chairs and a lamp out of the way. They dropped it in front of the door as, beneath them, something scraped across the concrete like it was being dragged. Heavy footsteps shook the foundation of the house. The high-pitched whine of malfunctioning electronics filled the air, almost too high to hear. Jessica rubbed her ears.
Are they coming for us?
No, I mean, I don't think so, John said.
He looked to Clay for reassurance, but Clay's eyes were on the door. The whine intensified and Jessica clapped her hands over her ears. The footsteps grew louder. There was a noise like cracking wood.
At the door, Clay whispered.
There was a loud thud, and then another. John, Jessica, and Clay sank down behind the desk, as if it would better hide them. Another thud resounded, then a sound of splintering wood. The earth-shaking footsteps came closer. John tried to count them, to see if the creatures were all together, but there was too much overlap. They layered one over another, rattling his teeth and shaking through his chest. It felt like the sound alone might break him to pieces. Then quickly, the footsteps faded and were gone. For a long moment, no one moved. John gasped to breathe, realizing only now that he'd been holding his breath. He looked at the others. Jessica's eyes were closed, and she gripped her hands together so tightly that her fingertips had gone white. John reached out and touched her shoulder, and she jumped, her eyes flying open. Clay was already standing, tugging at the desk.
Come on, John, he said. Help me get this out of the way.
Right, he said unsteadily. Together, they shoved it aside and hurried out into the hall. The front door stood wide open to the night. John rushed out to look. The grass outside had been torn up where the mascots shuffled through it. The tracks were obvious and easy to follow, leading straight into the woods. John broke into a run, chasing after them, Clay and Jessica at his heels. When they reached the cover of trees, they slowed. In the distance, John saw a blur of movement for only an instant, and he motioned the others to hold back. They would follow, but they didn't dare be seen by whatever was leading the way. Chapter 12. The world thundered around Charlie, shaking her rhythmically back and forth, strange objects digging harder into her each time she was jostled. Charlie opened her eyes and remembered where she was, or rather, what she was inside. The awful image of the malformed Freddy sucking her into its mouth like some kind of snake hit her, and she closed her eyes again, biting her lips together so that she wouldn't scream. The thuds were footsteps, she realized. The animatronics were on the move. Her head throbbed with each blow, making it hard to think straight. I must have been knocked unconscious when it threw me in here, she thought. The torso of the thing was connected to the head by a wide neck, which was almost level with her own, though its head stretched up another foot above her. It was like looking at the inside of a mask, the hollow of a protruding snout, the blank spheres that were the backs of the eyes. When she carefully tilted her head up, she could even see the bolt that attached the black top hat. Charlie's legs were cramped and bent at odd angles, wedged between pieces of machinery. She must have been stuck this way for some time, but she had no way of knowing how long. Her arms were constrained, suspended away from her body into the arms of the suit. Her whole body was covered in small points of pain, bruises and cuts from tiny pieces of plastic and metal that deepened each time they banged against her. Charlie could feel blood trickling down her skin in half a dozen places. She itched to wipe it away, but had no idea how much she could struggle without triggering the springs. Her mind flashed to the first murder victim, the lacerations that covered his body almost decoratively. She thought of Dave's screams as he died, and the bloated corpse beneath the stage at Pirate's Cove. That can't be me. I can't die like that. Charlie had told Clay what she knew about the spring lock suits. The animatronic parts were either recoiled, making room for a person inside to use it as a costume, or fully extended, so the mascot would work as a robot. But that was what Charlie knew from Fredbear's Family Diner. This creature was different. She was inside a cavity made for a human being, but the suit was moving with complete autonomy. Its insides were full of metal architecture and wires, all except for the space that Charlie occupied. The animatronic lurched unexpectedly to the side, and Charlie was smacked against the jagged wall again with greater force. She cried out this time, unable to help herself, but there was no break in Freddy's stride. Either the creature hadn't heard, or it didn't care. She clenched her teeth, trying to quell the pounding in her head. Where are we going? She craned her neck this way and that, looking through the holes in the animatronic's battered suit. There were only a few holes, small and on either side of the thing's torso. All she could make out was the forest, trees rushing by in the darkness as they hurried to their mysterious destination. Charlie sighed in frustration, tears welling up. Where are you? Am I getting closer to you? Sammy, is it you? She gave up looking for hints outside and stared straight ahead at the inside of the suit. Stay calm, Aunt Jen's voice said in her head. Always stay calm. It's the only way to keep your head clear. She stared up into the mask, at the inside-out features of the twisted Freddy. Suddenly, the blank spheres rolled back and the eyes flipped in, staring straight down at her with an impassive, plastic gaze. Charlie screamed and jerked back. Something behind her snapped, lashing a whip-like piece of metal into her side. She froze in terror. No, please no. Nothing else triggered, and after a moment she cautiously settled herself in place, trying not to meet the shiny blue eyes above her. Her side where the piece of metal had hit her shocked with pain each time she breathed. She wondered, alarmed, if a rib had broken.